Democratic caucus in Texas. The trips that we are currently having right now with elected officials all over the United States, we're not necessarily telling them to do anything. We're just advising them of what's going on in Texas and having discussions with them about what we are seeing in our state, the sham process of the redistricting committee that turned out the maps. What we have seen from our Republican leadership and how they are bowing down to Donald Trump, and just giving them a history of what's going on in Texas, because this is very unprecedented to see the redistricting happening as it is right now. It should not be happening right now. And so that just goes to show and confirms why the quorum break, in fact, happened, because we are in unprecedented times.
We just have 5 seconds.
The last decision that we needed to make in order to make sure that we protect our democracy.
We only have 5 seconds. Are you planning not to go back to Texas for 2 weeks the rest of the term?
We are taking it day by day, hour by hour. We're just going to make sure that whatever we do it united, and we prioritize not only Texans and our districts and our constituents, but also the American people.
We have to leave it there. Democratic Texas State Representative Cassandra Garcia speaking to us from Chicago. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition, presenting their Dance for a Cause event in support of immigrant justice. The event is on Sunday, August 10th, from 4 to 10 p.m. at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, and will feature a lineup of 4 bands and a DJ. Tickets and info at pircoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Hannah Ahern, who filed a lawsuit about a 2019 police assault case, might get her settlement this Thursday at City Council. California and Texas are exhibiting some major political jockeying. And in international news, Mel Gertov gives us a deeper look at what the 1948 definition of genocide is. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 5th, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. This week at City Council, the agenda for Thursday includes a settlement from the city to Hannah Ahern, who was assaulted by the Portland police in 2019, at a conflict between Proud Boy rally participants and counter-protesters. Ahern was physically shoved to the ground and arrested by 5 officers for spitting in the direction of the Portland police to show distaste for how they were handling counter-protesters. Hannah Ahern sued the city and police detective Eric Kammerer for false arrest and battery in the U.S. District Court. Kammerer can be seen in photos watching Ahern spit at the police in contempt. The lawsuit blames Kammerer for ordering the arrest without probable cause, merely punishing her for showing contempt for the riot police. Eric Kammerer was under investigation the September before for striking a black homeowner on the head when he had complained about tear gas seeping into his home during a protest. 3 protesters also alleged that he had physically assaulted them during a protest. Despite mounting evidence that, as Ahern's attorney Juan Chavez argued, Kammerer is clearly not to be trusted. He was not charged with anything from the 2020 protests due to, quote, insufficient evidence. Paying the settlement to Hannah Ahern for her bodily injury lawsuit will be brought to City Council on Thursday at the regular City Council meeting at 2 p.m. A federal judge in Texas has struck down a Biden-era Consumer Financial Protection Bureau rule that removed medical debt from the credit reports of Americans. Consumer advocates and health practitioners are concerned that millions of people will find themselves under increasing financial pressure. Eva Stahl is the Vice President for Public Policy and Program Management at Undo Medical Debt. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Stahl about the medical debt issue.
So how serious a problem is this in the U.S., medical debt?
Sure. So medical debt is quite pervasive. It's estimated at about $220 billion nationwide, affecting over 100 million people. So no one can really escape the experience of medical debt in some form, whether it's a family, a friend, or a neighbor. It really is universal in affecting all of us.
So this affects people's entire financial outlook, I guess, where sometimes they pretty much go bankrupt, would you say?
Yeah, it still remains one of the number one reasons for bankruptcy, for sure. But even small amounts of medical debt can really ripple through a family's households, right? In sort of thinking about their analysis of trade-offs between basic needs, being able to access housing, a job. So it definitely ripples through people's lives.
Does it hit certain states harder than others?
So it actually is in as much as it is universal in its experience, it does disproportionately affect some people and some communities more than others. Most notably, there have been research studies that show that there's more medical debt in states that have not expanded the Medicaid program. And that's largely because those people don't have the protective factor of insurance.
What's the relationship here between the medical debt issue and the whole Medicaid issue in general, the funding cuts there?
Sure. So it's kind of a double whammy, right? When you think about the fact that the judge vacated this rule to protect people from medical debt on their credit reports, that's kind of a downstream effect. But really what protects people and prevents medical debt is having comprehensive and affordable insurance. And certainly the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that just recently passed by Congress will have significant cuts to coverage across the country.
If you live in certain states, you could be better off. You could be in a better position.
Perhaps, depending how your state chooses to respond. But certainly states that have expanded their Medicaid program are more at risk because they have to absorb the loss of federal funding.
And what about the racial aspect or the socioeconomic aspect, you might say?
A lot of medical debt really sits in Black households, right? They are disproportionately affected. And that is often correlated to sort of the trajectory around wealth building. I would also say that low and middle income folks, particularly those living under 400% of the federal poverty level, which is about like $125,000 for a family of three, that those households are disproportionately affected as well. And that's largely because if you think about the fact that they don't have an extra $500 or could afford a surprise bill of $500 that they didn't anticipate, it's really about cash flow.
Is this a problem that exists in other countries, other so-called advanced industrial countries?
It's largely a pretty unique American experience, for sure.
Any moves in Congress right now to rectify the situation, or is it too soon?
It's pretty uncertain at the moment. Largely what's coming out of Washington are deep cuts to our healthcare program, whether it's the Medicaid program, whether it's Affordable Care and Care Act plans, or hospitals themselves, right? We're largely seeing cuts in funding, and it really will require states to step up and be creative and innovative to make sure that hospital doors can stay open. So with that in mind, I don't think that there's a lot of activity on the issue of medical debt currently, but certainly there's a lot of activity at the state level. So to date, we've seen about 15 states ban medical debt on credit reports and have told providers, physicians, healthcare providers that they cannot report unpaid medical bills to credit reporting agencies. So this is one of the best protections that patients can have from having medical debt show up on their credit report.
Is this issue, medical debt, likely to come up in the courts at all?
So to date, it's largely shown up in the space of the credit reporting and around the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And to see the debate largely in the court system seems to sit in that particular space. But I don't foresee it coming up in other spaces.
Can you see people just not seeking medical care because of this issue?
Yeah, it's definitely something we worry a lot about. And we know from our constituents when we abolish their debt and have conversations afterwards that they're quite fearful of medical debt. It ruins people's lives and they want to make sure that they never accrue it again. And largely how they do that is by skipping care, deferring care, or rationing care for them and their families.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
No, I would just reiterate that medical debt is not a debt of choice. It's a debt of necessity, and we all need to remember that.
That's Eva Stahl of Undo Medical Debt, speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
States reject Department of Justice requests for voter records. Texas governor threatens to remove Democratic lawmakers who fled the state from office. And new federal legislation would set minimum salaries for all public school teachers. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The DOJ doesn't get to know everything about you just because they want to. I believe strongly in voter privacy. The federal government is overstepping its bounds.
Maine Secretary of State Shayna Bellows says she won't turn over the state's voter registration list to the federal Department of Justice. DOJ wants more than a dozen states to share data on the 2024 and 2020 elections, it says, as part of a greater plan to combat voter fraud. States that don't cooperate risk losing federal aid. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says Democrats who fled the state to block a vote on a new congressional redistricting map could face fines, criminal charges, and potentially lose their jobs.
These Democrats have absconded from the responsibility, and I believe they have forfeited their seats in the state legislature because they are not doing the job they were elected to do.
President Donald Trump told Texas Republicans to change district maps to gain 5 congressional seats in the midterms. Democrats say the gerrymander knowingly disenfranchises Black and Hispanic voters and that removing elected officials from office for resisting the effort would be illegal. New York Governor Kathy Hochul is hosting some of the refugee legislators and says she's ready to fight fire with fire.
All spare and love and war. That's why I'm exploring with our leaders every option to redraw our state congressional lines as soon as possible.
Hochul says New York may disband its independent redistricting commission to do that. California Governor Gavin Newsom is also threatening a retaliatory gerrymander, although that would take amending the state constitution. New federal legislation would ensure all public school teachers earn at least $60,000 a year. Educators praise the Pay Teachers Act, citing many teachers' reliance on second jobs or public assistance to get by. Corey O'Hare is a sixth grade social studies teacher with Boston Public Schools.
We come home exhausted, only to have to work a side gig to make ends meet. People aren't walking away from the profession, they're being priced out of it.
The bill would also provide teachers with a $1,000 annual stipend for classroom supplies, which they often pay for themselves. The Trump administration says states and cities that boycott Israeli companies will be denied federal natural disaster preparation aid. The ban would apply to nearly $2 billion for search and rescue equipment, backup power systems, and salaries for emergency personnel. The State Department says it will require certain travelers entering the U.S. with tourism and business visas to pay bonds up to $15,000. Officials say they'll target nationals from countries with a high rate of overstaying their visas. And House Oversight Chair Republican James Comer of Kentucky says he plans to subpoena the Justice Department for files related to Jeffrey Epstein this week. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview by Emma Lugo with Bill Bigelow and Susanna Kasouf about their book, Teaching Palestine. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 82 degrees and a low of 62, with some late occasional rain. And tomorrow, it will be a high of 72 and a low of 60, with some showers throughout the day. Today in history, in 1859, the first transatlantic telegraph cable was completed. There is now almost 1 million miles of underwater cable connecting the world. The quote of the day is from Angela Davis. In her book, Are Prisons Obsolete?, she says, quote, "Prison relieves us of the responsibility of seriously engaging with the problems of our society, especially those produced by racism and, increasingly, global capitalism." Researchers are trying to better understand intensifying landslides due to climate change in the native village of Klukwan, Alaska. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The native village of Klukwan, just north of Haines, Alaska, is grappling with landslide risk that's intensifying with climate change. It's also posing a major obstacle to the community's growth. The village is in the thick of a research project to better understand the threat, and as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, residents hope the information will guide housing development in the years to come.
Decades ago in the Chilkat Valley, heavy rains would send mudflows tumbling down the Tokchinook Mountains, over the International Highway, and into Klukwan. Dan Hotch remembers it well. He says the slides in the 70s, 80s, and 90s would damage buildings and send rocks and mud under the deck of his family's home.
Growing up as a kid, we hated August and September weather because we knew the rains were coming and we knew the water was going to be coming down.
Then, about 25 years ago, a community member built a berm to direct the debris away from the village. It worked, says Hotch, who is now an environmental specialist with the Chilkat Indian Village. But that's starting to shift as the slide path evolves and in some instances points the sediment back toward Klukwan. That has major implications for the community's long-term future. The tribe wants to expand the village, which is currently home to roughly 90 residents. But the major question is where new housing should go amid intensifying landslide risk. The conundrum isn't isolated to Klukwan. Communities around the world are scrambling to figure out how to protect homes and build new ones as natural disasters intensify with climate change. In the Chilkat Valley, work is already underway to better understand and reduce those risks.
And we're walking across large mounds of debris, big boulders.
That's Josh Roaring, a University of Oregon-based geomorphologist involved in the project. Walking through a dense patch of forest on a recent field visit to Klukwan, he points to little black boxes strapped high on trees.
These are called infrasound sensors, so they're recording things that we are not hearing, but it is happening in the environment.
The tribe will ideally be able to use that information to plan new berms, support grant applications, and support safe community development. Hotch says that could encourage tribal members to move home. That idea is personal. He moved back to Klukwan about a decade ago after spending a number of years in Oregon for boarding school and later for work.
Great to be home. I need more people back at home.
The ongoing research is an early step in that direction. In Klukwan, I'm Avery Elfelt.
Native leaders visited Ireland this summer, including a delegation which presented a Navajo rug to Ireland's parliament. Shaw McPullen explains.
Former Navajo Nation Attorney General Ethel Branch presented the Irish parliament with a rug by weaver Florence Riggs. Branch led a delegation from the Navajo and Hopi family's COVID-19 relief fund. The rug was a thank you gift for the estimated $3 million in donations from Ireland to the two nations during the pandemic, including $100,000 from U2 drummer Larry Mullen. The rug depicts the Kindred Spirit sculpture in the Irish county of Cork, which honors Choctaw Nation donations to Irish famine victims in the 1840s. That gift inspired the World Peace Gathering last month, featuring Branch and Hereditary Chief Phil Lane Jr. of the Yankton, Dakota, and Chickasaw tribes. During the event, he honored the Irish people.
They've suffered as we've suffered. and they still are the most giving people per capita in the world, in the entire world. I give you a hand for the Irish for that.
For National Native News, I'm Sean McPullen in Ireland.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
The two biggest U.S. states by population, California and Texas, are doing some major political jockeying. All this in advance of the 2026 elections, in moves designed to potentially reorder the balance of power in Washington and to affect Donald Trump's agenda. In Texas, Democrats prevented a House of Representatives plan to move forward with the redrawn congressional map sought by Trump. In California, Democrats, with support of Governor Newsom, are themselves considering new political maps that could eliminate five Republican-held House seats. That move is intended to undercut any GOP plans in Texas and could swing House control back to the Democrats. A draft plan is aimed at boosting the Democratic margin in California to 48 of 52 congressional seats. That's an increase from the 43 seats the party now holds. The move would need approval from lawmakers and voters, and follows handing over redistricting power to an independent commission years ago. Texas Democrats just provoked a standoff by leaving the state. This left the Republican-dominated Senate without a quorum of lawmakers required to conduct business. The Republican governor, Greg Abbott, threatened to remove members who were absent from their seats, but Democrats said he is asserting legal authority he does not have. The Texas House quickly issued civil warrants for absent Democrats, and Abbott ordered state troopers to help find and arrest them. However, lawmakers physically outside Texas are beyond the jurisdiction of state authorities. House Speaker and Representative Dustin Burroughs said, quote, "If you continue to go down this road, there will be consequences," end quote. He said those consequences include fines. Other Democratic governors have pondered redrawing their district maps in retaliation for Texas. This all appears to follow Trump's efforts to get five more GOP-leaning congressional seats in Texas before the midterms. That would bolster his party's chances of preserving its fragile U.S. House majority. Republicans were unable to do that in the 2018 midterms during Trump's first presidency. Right now, Republicans currently hold 25 of Texas's 38 seats, a nearly 2-to-1 advantage. Trump was quite popular in Texas, winning 56.1% of the vote, but the redistricting fraction could be even larger. The tentative California proposal is designed to induce a voter shift, making it likely some districts now held by Republicans would then see a left-leaning candidate prevail in each race. In other battleground districts held by Democrats, the measure would strengthen their hold on the seats. Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom has already said he wants to advance partisan redistricting. He says he will not move ahead if Texas pauses its efforts. For now, Newsom said he'd call a special election for the first week of November to decide the new congressional map. Newsom said, quote, "California will not sit by idly and watch this democracy waste away," end quote. The Texas walkout might just delay passage of their bill. For now, lawmakers cannot pass bills in the 150-member House without two-thirds of its members present. Democrats hold 62 seats, and at least 51 left the state. Today, on the Global Citizen Commentary, Israel has violated the UN Genocide Convention in multiple ways, including its intent to kill the Palestinian population, impose starvation conditions, and forcibly remove it altogether from the Gaza Strip. This genocide can only be stopped by imposing a no-exceptions arms embargo on Israel until it agrees with Hamas to a permanent ceasefire. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Many scholars and progressives are reluctant to call Israel's actions in Gaza genocide. They will agree that Israel's behavior is abominable and condemnable, but nevertheless falls below the threshold of a genocide. Their reasoning may stem from partiality toward Israel, no matter what it does, from the belief that Hamas's brutal October 2023 attack must also count as genocide, or from a conception of genocide that must match the numbers of dead in the Holocaust gas chambers. But while the 1948 Geneva Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide resulted directly from the Holocaust, genocide in international law is defined by several other acts besides the extinction of an entire population. Here is how Article 2 of the Convention defines genocide. Any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group: killing members of the group, causing serious bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Intent is the key motivation that distinguishes genocide from war crimes. Omar Bartov is a prominent Israeli historian and genocide specialist who has changed his mind and now calls out Israel for intent to commit genocide. In a New York Times op-ed, July 15, he wrote, quote, "Israel's actions could be understood only as the implementation of the expressed intent to make the Gaza Strip uninhabitable for its Palestinian population. I believe the goal was, and remains today, to force the population to leave the Strip altogether or, considering that it has nowhere to go, to debilitate the enclave through bombings and severe deprivation of food, clean water, sanitation, and medical aid. My inescapable conclusion has become that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people." About 60,000 Palestinians, overwhelmingly innocent civilians, and including around 18,500 children, have now been killed in the Gaza fighting, according to Gaza health officials. The targeted killing of people as a group is genocide under Article 2A of the Geneva Convention. Two recent developments strengthen the case for genocide. One is Israel's weaponization of food assistance. The other is Israeli annexation plans following on the forced removal of the population. Minimal food distribution is causing hundreds of deaths in what can only be considered a deliberate effort to starve the population, in violation of Article 2 B and C of the Convention. Feeding the Gaza population would have been possible if the method of food distribution had changed to allow for regular and abundant deliveries without a major Israeli military presence. But Israel has failed to take full responsibility, putting food and aid in the hands of a Gaza humanitarian foundation and its mainly American contractors. That arrangement has led to numerous deaths and injuries as crowds surge to get food and are then shot by Israeli Defense Forces soldiers, who are supposed to be there for crowd control. Food aid organizations have called for that organization to be shut down. The Israeli authorities know exactly how much food, measured in calories per day, the average Palestinian needs to survive. What is actually being allowed into Gaza is below the minimum. Starvation is the predictable result. A British surgeon who spent 3 weeks in Gaza helping the wounded says, quote, "We're at the point where people have been reduced to such a level of deprivation that they're prepared to die for a bag full of rice and a bit of pasta." The starvation policy may not simply be directed at weakening Hamas. I believe its chief purpose is to force the Palestinian population to submit to Israeli plans for its removal from Gaza altogether, a violation of the Geneva Conventions Article 2C and E. Forcible removal of large segments of the population has occurred several times already. Now there is a plan to establish a humanitarian city, quote-unquote, for Palestinians near the Egyptian border. Israel's defense secretary has ordered the start of planning on a camp that would house 600,000 Palestinians. Former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert denounced the idea, saying this city would be a concentration camp and forcing the population into it would be ethnic cleansing. These forced removals are part of Israeli plans for annexing the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Israel is a party to the Genocide Convention and should be forced to comply with it. At a minimum, the U.S. and other governments supplying Israel with arms and military-related equipment must impose an unconditional embargo. No exceptions, no distinction between defensive and offensive weapons. The embargo should last until Israel signs a permanent ceasefire with Hamas that leads to the release of all remaining Israeli hostages. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
In the past year, 4 billion people experienced a whole extra month of extreme heat. This is the direct result of human-caused climate change. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From Mexico to Mongolia, Sweden to South Africa,
many, many, many people across the globe are feeling the effects of extreme heat that is fueled by climate change.
Roop Singh is at the Red Cross Red Crescent Climate Center, which co-authored a report about global extreme heat from May 2024 to May 2025.
We found that 4 billion people, about 49% of the global population, experience at least 30 additional days of extreme heat due to human-caused climate change.
And in many areas of the tropics, people saw more than 100 additional days of extreme heat. That is, days that are hotter than 90% of the temperatures historically observed in the local area. Extreme heat can be deadly, but Singh says cities and countries can help protect residents, for example, by educating people on how to stay hydrated, increasing access to air conditioning, and developing early warning systems for heat waves.
This threat is here and now. It's not really a future problem. It will continue to get worse, but there are tons of actions that we can take to reduce the impacts.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem and James Kemp. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mel Gertov, David Rosenberg, Brian Bull, Catherine Carley, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for an interview about the new book, Teaching Palestine.